It's time for Windows Weekly with Paul Thurrott and Mary Jo Foley. Paul and I bore Mary Jo with some gaming lust. Edge improves your battery life. Windows Mobile gets tap to pay. And Paul finds some mobile apps that aren't horrible. Windows Weekly is next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Windows Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Windows Weekly with Paul Thurrott and Mary Jo Foley. Episode 471, recorded June 22nd, 2016. Mary Jo is a gamer. Windows Weekly is brought to you by Igloo Software. Igloo is an internet you'll actually like. It connects people with the information they need to do their best work. Try it for free at igloosoftware.com/twit or sign up for a live demo to see it in action. And by the Ring Video Doorbell. With Ring, you can see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. It's like caller ID for your house. Go to ring.com/WW and get $50 off one of their Ring of Security kits, the Bundle Kit or Pro Bundle Kit, with their limited time offer. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century with a fast, easy, and completely online process. Check out Rocket Mortgage today at quickenloans.com/windows. Hey, it's time for Windows Weekly. It's the show that we download directly into your brain like a bad copy of Windows 10. Here with us, of course, is Paul Thurrott and Mary Jo Foley. Paul Thurrott, he is the guru behind Thurrott.com, the purveyor of news, reviews, analysis for all tech enthusiasts of all ages. Paul, it's good to see you, my friend.
Thank you. You too. And there are no bad copies of Windows 10, just bad copies of people who use Windows 10.
Okay. we'll get to that because I may have a little objection to that statement, but I have no objection to Mary Jo Foley. She is the wonderful, the enchanting woman from All About Microsoft. That's right. Not all about Android, as I'm bound to say, but she's here to give us her color commentary and deep analysis into the world of Microsoft. Mary Jo Foley, it's good to see you too as well.
Same, Padre.
Now, it's been a couple of busy weeks, everything from E3 to a few big acquisitions, but what do we have in store for our audience, Paul?
Well, let's see. Let me move first to this week's notes. Right before we started, I just switched computers, and it looks like Microsoft bought LinkedIn, and there was an E3 show.
Hold on.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, those are good things. They all happen
Wrong
very well.
Week.
Yeah. But let's re-celebrate, though, shall we?
Absolutely. Yes. Now, I know that neither of you were at E3, yes?
No.
Yeah.
Correct.
That was a fun show, if for nothing else than the fact that Microsoft booth was the place to be. We went through the entire show. Sony, Nintendo, they had decent booths, and actually Nintendo had one that was very, very nice, where it was all dedicated to their new Zelda game. But Microsoft was the place to go if you actually wanted hands-on experience with the software, the hardware. I haven't had that much fun at a show probably ever.
You'd have to be a jaundiced Sony guy to think that anyone but Microsoft won E3, you know?
because they look at the numbers. They say, well, Sony's still winning the console war, which is true.
That's not E3.
That's
what
not
I'm talking
E3,
about. No. E3 is a peek at the future. It's about drumming up excitement for the platform. It's for what's coming next. And I think Microsoft kind of owned it, frankly.
Yeah. And Paul, let me get your input on this, because I've heard people go back and forth about the new console. People are saying that Microsoft Osborne'd themselves because they also announced Project Scorpio. Yep. But for me, the possibility of having a $299 console, that's the 500 gigabyte version, that does HDR, which is something I really, really wanted to play with, but there's just no content for HDR. That has me excited. I saw a demo of Gears of War in their HDR area, and it was fantastic.
Did your eyes bleed a little bit?
A little bit. I mean, you don't realize until you see a proper HDR setup how not black your blacks are and how not white your whites are when you're watching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When the rumors about Sony doing this kind of thing for the PS4 started occurring a month or two ago, I, at that time, said Microsoft needs to do exactly this same strategy. It's brilliant. It doesn't matter that this isn't how consoles have evolved over the years. Times are different. this is a more modern way of kind of considering the life cycle of a console. And then, you know, a few weeks before they announced it, I did talk to Microsoft about this. And they, you know, they asked some very pointed questions at that time about, you know, what did I think about this? What were the downsides? What do you, how do you answer these kinds of complaints? And I'll tell you what I told them, which is, I don't think there are any downsides to this. You know, I've read some, and I meant to write an article about this today. It's funny you brought this up first. And I actually talked to Mary Jo about this before the show as well. But my take on this is that this is exactly the right strategy for what we might consider the second half of the Xbox One's life cycle. Typical console life cycle is about 8 years. Historically, console makers like Microsoft have done cost-reducing updates over time where you bring in a new version of the console, but the capabilities are the same. It's just that the components have changed so that they're cheaper to sell and they can make more a profit or more of a profit. And they're cheaper for consumers to buy. And so over the lifetime of the console, obviously the costs go down for everybody. It's great. This approach is more like how PC gaming has been forever. In the PC gaming world, PC gaming being the biggest market for, you know, what we might call real gaming, if you will, has always dealt with different resolutions, different, you know, effects, graphical effects, different sound, you know, types of sound output, different setups of all kinds. And it's not always very clean. I mean, one of the nice things about the console world is that you kind of have this known thing and you know it's going to work. But this is kind of the best of both worlds approach. And so by having this kind of tiered offering where you have an original Xbox One, you have an Xbox One S that brings in additional capabilities, like you said, 4K video playback, the HDR gaming and so forth. And then a true step up, not a next generation console in the sense that it's not compatible with previous things, but kind of a next gen console from a capability perspective, 4K gaming capabilities, VR capabilities, although we don't know how that's going to be implemented yet and so forth. And the beauty of the strategy is the same games work everywhere. This isn't isolating anybody. If you're an early adopter, you're not getting screwed because this thing exists. If you want to use your original Xbox One for the next 5 years, you're all set. Every game that comes out for the Xbox One is going to work. And that's why it's genius. It pays people to upgrade because you'll see better effects, HDR gaming with an S, or have, you know, different capabilities that are non-gaming related on that console. And you'll have better game, better looking games, same games, but better looking games, and maybe VR capabilities as well if you move up to Project Scorpio. You know, whatever that's called. This is, to me, it's just a win-win. And it's so obvious, by the way, Sony is doing exactly the same thing. It's just that they're not ready to, you know, put something out into the market yet. I think by being transparent to Microsoft is escaping the problem they had at the original Xbox launch, where they were like the three stooges bumping into each other as they tried to find the exit from the room. Like, they couldn't get their story straight. And then they spent the next 3 months backtracking on every single thing they said they were going to do about the Xbox One. So, to me, Xbox One mirrors Windows in the sense that the original Xbox One was a little bit like Windows 8. They kind of screwed it up. They've been fixing it ever since. We're going to see like an Windows 8.1 release with the Xbox One S. And we're going to see a Windows 10 release with Project Scorpio. So I think it makes lots of sense.
Yeah, no. Yeah, it reminds me in some ways of the Surface strategy or even the Windows 10 strategy in that at this point, there aren't, I would argue there are not too many brand new people looking to buy an Xbox One. If you wanted it, you probably have it.
I don't have one yet.
You don't?
I was borrowing Leo's for a while, but that went away. So this, I might actually buy this one.
But you might get the S, right?
I might get the S. Right.
Yeah.
$300. So $300 isn't bad.
No, yep. And like the Surface, you know, a lot of people thought Microsoft would keep all the different Surface models in market when they came out with each one. And instead, whatever is the most current version is the one, kind of. I mean, there are others still available, but the focus goes to the newest product. So I feel like, yeah, you can still buy an Xbox One if you want. But now the focus this holiday is on Xbox One S, next year on Scorpio. So I don't feel like they shot themselves in the foot by showing the roadmap. I feel like they're kind of being honest with the users and saying, here's where we're going. Yeah,
it's smart. The difference and really, you can't stress this enough. I mean, the difference between going between different generations of Sega consoles or Nintendo consoles back in the day or PlayStation consoles, Xbox consoles as well, and going between an Xbox One and this Project Scorpio thing, again, is that the games still work, right? So, you know, just Mary Jo's Surface example, when you go from a Surface Pro 2 to a Surface Pro 4, the applications all work, right? I mean, that's the way it works. And that's sort of what I mean by the best of both worlds thing. This isn't because we can, 4 years in, we're going to make a huge, honking, new, awesome console that's completely different than the previous one. It's about doing the things you can do to improve the platform while retaining all those things that are super important about the platform. I'm not, you know, perfect is a tough word, but I think they're doing the right thing.
Yeah. And I really picked up on that whole, we need to think differently about what it means for a console release. Because you're right.
Yeah.
The whole idea of a console generation lasts 6 to 8 years, that's gone. We can't do that anymore. The technology is moving too quickly. But and I want to throw this to Mary Jo. One of the things that really had my ears perking up when I was upstairs in the lounge that we couldn't tape was they're leveraging all of the enterprise infrastructure that they've built up over the last couple of years, something that Sony cannot do. Sony does not have that. And like the best example is Minecraft. So Minecraft is a ridiculously popular title. You can now play across 14 different platforms, which is amazing. Right. But because they're running it off of Azure, you can actually have your world continue to exist even when you're not online. So you turn off your console, you own a world. You can say, no, let people in, let it grow, let time run for real inside that world because it's running on a live server. That's incredible. I mean, if you can do that for all of your worlds,
It's not cross-platform, but those kinds of advantages that certain companies have, you know, Amazon, for example, has physical goods and digital goods, and they can offer services that kind of combine the two, like their Prime membership, and that's kind of a unique thing for them. Sony doesn't really have that, right? I think the best Sony could do would be offer you life insurance as part of your PlayStation Now subscription or whatever, because that's something they sell in Asia. You know, like they really just don't have this deep machine learning compute infrastructure like Microsoft has.
Right. I mean, for a while, Microsoft was talking up the different new pieces of Xbox Live that were running on Azure. Like they were talking about, it was some piece of Halo, I can't remember now, that was using Project Orleans.
I have this idea in my head that there was something around Titanfall that, and maybe I'm getting the game wrong as well, but there was some game that was using Azure something on the back. Maybe it was Halo.
Right?
Maybe it was Halo. I don't remember.
Yeah. So, yeah, that definitely is an advantage for them and something that not everyone else has, as you said, Padre.
Yeah. And I think that's one of those things where people will see it as persistent gaming right now. But, and this fits into Microsoft's whole, we need to change the way we think about consoles. The fact that I will be able to play Halo Wars 2, which I'm excited about, on the Xbox One I'm going to buy, or my desktop, or my laptop, or my Android device, that's, I mean, yes, I want that. Buy it once, play it on any device that I have. As far as titles, I know that, Paul, you looked at some of the E3 coverage. Was there any title that got you perked up?
Well, so, yes. I'm locked in this disease called Call of Duty right now. And I actually have a hard time seeing past that. So Call of Duty happens to be in the Sony camp in the sense that they get the downloadable content first and so forth. But when you look at and obviously the next Call of Duty is coming on Xbox as well, obviously. But yeah, I mean, we're looking at the Xbox specific stuff and either the exclusives or the things there'll be some advantage to playing it on Xbox. I mean, honestly, there's some stuff like Gears of War 4, obviously, Dead Rising 4, and so forth. But the thing that the one that really gets me is a Call of Duty type game, Battlefield 1. And this game is controversial in its own way because they've decided to set this game in World War 1. And that is confusing to a lot of people. But when you look at the footage for this game, I'm reminded of some of the stuff that really was special about the early Call of Duty games, all of which took place in World War 2. It's just the kind of European environments, you know, that kind of early 1900s look, and then just the sheer quality of the graphics and gameplay. This looks amazing. So I am kind of a one-trick pony when it comes to video games, but I just sort of gravitate toward this kind of thing.
There was actually a title there, and Kara, I have that on my computer right now, called Cuphead. And it's an indie game, And they got some animators from Disney. And so this is in the style, the animation style of like Steamboat Willie.
Yeah, no, this we had seen this one before. But
like
I guess
a year
now
ago,
finally,
right?
Yeah, it's finally ready to come out, I guess.
It was actually a lot of fun to play.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
And then the other one I really liked was they have Sea of Thieves, which is sort of, it's a team. Have you ever played Project Artemis?
No.
It's sort of a Starship Simulator, but everybody has a role. So you have the helmsman, you have the captain, mm-hmm. you have the engineer, you have weapons control, shield control. And so you have to actually communicate with one another and all the tasks have to be done. This is sort of like that.
Right.
But you're in charge of a pirate ship. And then your team is meeting up with other teams at an MMORPG. It actually looked kind of cool. It's one of those things where it was just different enough that I thought it might be interesting.
Right. I don't want different. I want the same.
I talked about that at the Nintendo booth. One of the execs, off camera again, we were talking about how difficult is it to take a franchise like Zelda, which, it goes all the way back to the start of real mainstream gaming, and then advance it so that it feels like a more modern title without alienating all the people who loved everything about the way that it used to run. And he said that's the most difficult thing to do. In so many ways, that's why indie studios can do things that we can't, because they create titles that haven't existed before.
They're not constrained by such enormous success of the past. I mean, Nintendo has examples of places where they did that, right? Remember the Nintendo 64? There was this kind of a 3D version of Mario, for example, right? Which at the time was kind of impressive. I mean, today we would look at that as a fairly obvious follow-up to the 2D scrollers they had before that. But, I mean, it's a necessary step. I mean, now you can make graphics where the games look like movies. I mean, so bringing forward the cartoon characters of the 1980s and 90s and stuff is, a little more challenging. Well, like Doom is an example of this kind of thing. Doom is, like the modern version of the video game version of a horror movie franchise, like Friday the 13th just keeps coming back every once in a while and it gets more realistic, probably isn't the right word, but more gruesome as it goes, I guess.
Gruesome. I like gruesome. Mary Jo, you're not a gamer, right?
I am not.
But would you consider getting a Xbox console as your media center?
No, I don't have a TV.
Okay. Oh, but you don't need a TV. You can play your Xbox over a Windows 10 desktop.
I don't have a Windows 10 desktop.
No. Never mind then. I guess this is all kind of...
Sorry, guys. I'm a downer on this convo. I don't care in the least about gaming.
But Enterprise.
Nope, boring.
Data center.
Sorry.
Oh. Okay.
Give me Notepad, please.
All right. Well, you know what? I think it's time to move into actual Microsoft Windows news. Gaming is fun. But let's get down to the meat and potatoes. But before we do that, let's take just a moment to thank the first sponsor of this episode of Windows Weekly. Now, let me ask you something. All you IT folk out there, do you like your ISDN modems? Are you happy with your 486 processors? How's the ARCNET? Is it holding up under the traffic? Well, of course not. All those technologies are obsolete. We don't do that anymore. That's not how the technology world works. But if you're not using that technology, why are you still using an intranet from the 80s and the 90s? That's just not going to work. That's why we are so happy to have Igloo as a sponsor of Windows Weekly. Now, Igloo is an intranet that you'll actually like. It combines all the features that you've come to expect from a solid intranet type system, where it gives you all the information you need at your fingertips. It also gives you everything you expect from the internet, where you get comments and likes and the ability to use widgets. Now, Igloo is, they're an understanding company. What they understand is that you need to put all the information that your employees need in a single place, brand it with your branding, and then make it dead simple to use on any device that they might have. That's exactly what they do. It's a cloud platform that helps you share your files, collaborate on documents, blog updates, coordinate your calendars, and manage your projects. Anyone can add content based on their permissions with drag-and-drop widgets and with a WYSIWYG editor. And they offer a variety of access, authentication, and identity services to ensure that only your authorized users have access in private clouds, over SSL, and with 256-bit encryption. Now, unlike other solutions that force you to use their branding, force you to use their look and feel, Igloo will customize to you, to your needs, and work with your current IT investments. There's no forklifting here. You can use it with the Office 365, Salesforce, SharePoint, Active Directory, and file sharing solutions like Google Drive and Dropbox. You can even add Zendesk to keep track of or add new support tickets. Now, it's used by large enterprises and growing companies like User Testing, BDO, American Family Insurance, and ATP World Tour. If those companies trust Igloo, don't you think you should too? And you can try it for free at igloosoftware.com/twit. That's igloosoftware.com/twit. Or you can sign up for a live demo to see it in action. And when you sign up through our link, you can get your own Igloo for up to 10 people absolutely free for as long as you want. Now, Igloo will be at the Microsoft Worldwide Partner Conference from July 10th to 14th. If you're going, check them out at booth 229 and learn more about a modern internet firsthand. Now, if you can't, you can still sign up for a free trial. Again, that's igloosoftware.com/twit. Igloo, a better way to run your office. And we thank them for their support of Windows Weekly. Okay, you know what would really kick off my week? Learning something about Edge. I just wish there was some Edge news.
Wow.
Your wish has been granted.
All right. What do we got?
So this week, Microsoft started talking up battery saving capabilities of Edge. And I guess it's not that surprising they've started doing this since there are so many reports about what a battery hog Chrome is on Windows. But now they've set up a whole testing lab at Microsoft and they've been benchmarking Edge versus Chrome versus the new power saving version of Opera versus Firefox. And, you know, it is Microsoft's test, obviously, but the findings are that Edge saves you significantly more battery than any of those other browsers. So, you know, it's interesting. Right now, their Edge adoption has not been huge, although Microsoft claims they're very happy with it. At ZDNet, we ran a story recently saying only 1 out of 4 Windows 10 users are using Edge right now. But that's for a variety of reasons. It doesn't support extensions yet. I also have found it kind of slow in opening pages that I visit. Sometimes the pages don't render correctly. So I actually use Chrome on my Windows 10 laptop a lot more than I use Edge. But I'm optimistic. I like hearing that there's a reward for using Edge. And if it really does save as much battery as they're claiming, it might make me use it once the anniversary update is out.
Well, I mean, I like the fact that it saves battery. Anything that can give me a longer runtime on my laptop is fantastic. But I'm like you. Right. I've tried Edge. I thought it was kind of nice. But then within the hour, I was back to Chrome.
Paul? Well, you missed something. If you've spent any time in any browser and you're kind of used to the way things work and, you know, I sign into Chrome and all of the add-ins I have all auto sign, you know, all appear and all that stuff. It's nice. And, you know, I mean, even in the original version of Windows 10, the shipping version of Windows 10, there are some advantages to Chrome. I really think that the text and graphics rendering, especially in high DPI displays, is especially good. Scrolling is really smooth. The performance is good and that kind of stuff. But yeah, I'm trying, and I have a tip later on about kind of adapting to Edge, but it's hard to get people to switch from something they're really familiar and comfortable with.
You know, it's funny because in the chat room they're saying, "Look, when will Edge have the plugins and the extension that Chrome and Firefox have?" Which I get that some people really like that, but my Chrome is pretty much bare. There's like maybe 4 plugins that I have running, and they typically relate to Google products. So, for me, it's experience, and Chrome still has the best experience.
This is going to sound more extreme than I intended to, but you know, browser add-ins or extensions are a little bit like mobile apps, right? You could make this argument that there are enough, you know, and there probably will be enough or some good number of them in Edge. But I mean, I'm looking at my own browser now, and there are some kind of esoteric little add-ins that I've added that are important to me. And some of them are on Edge already, like Pocket, Get Pocket, or AdBlocker, and so forth. And some aren't. And the little things. You can get price checking add-ins for, you know, you're buying something on the web and it will say, hey, you can get it cheaper here. Or you're buying something on the web and here's a coupon you can use for this exact site. Like it will actually check it and say, like, this will work for what you're buying, you know. And so it's you know, those are niceties. These are not things that are absolutely necessary, but I do think there's sort of a parallel there. I mean, if you're, and that's part of the trouble of getting someone to move, because it's not just the UI and how it looks and works and so forth. I mean, a lot of it is just the little things that are, you know, that in some ways can be important. And when you use Edge, what you might find over time is that you miss that thing, you know, and I think that's what happens with people when they go back.
I like the reading view in Edge. That's really great. The scrolling support, if you use touch on Edge, is really good. I don't know. The look and feel of Chrome isn't what keeps me on Chrome. I guess it is. It's more habit. You know, you just kind of know how it works and just use
it. It's a known quantity.
It is.
Well, Edge has what IE had, which is if you're using a touchscreen, it scrolls so much more smoothly than Chrome. I never understood why Google couldn't fix Chrome so that when you do this, it doesn't move like Google Docs 20 lines.
That's always been a problem. And a lot of people, and myself included, have spent a lot of time playing with settings and trying to figure out, you know, how do you fix that thing? And
and CPU usage as well.
That we're going to be right. What's that?
CPU usage as well. I've noticed because whenever I have a bunch of Chrome tabs open, it starts to hog the CPU until I find whatever window has a flash implementation that's freaking out. I've never gotten that in Edge. And yet, maybe it is habit. But even though I know those things are better in Edge, I know that scrolling is better. I know that CPU usage, and now I know battery usage is better.
The battery one doesn't surprise me in the slightest, by the way. I think, didn't we all sort of suspect that Chrome was a problem? You can run a battery test in Windows 10 from the command line. And, you know, I had done this, about a month ago or so ago, and I've been doing it ever since because I leave Photoshop running in the background all the time because that's one of the things I use when I'm working. But as it turns out, Photoshop is the absolute worst thing you can leave running on a battery-powered laptop. So in my case, it makes more sense to load Photoshop, do what I'm going to do, and shut it off than just leave it sitting there in the background while I write. But the second worst one is almost certainly Chrome, right? I mean, it's and Chrome is probably one of the worst offenders on anyone's computer other than maybe games or things of that nature. I mean, Chrome is infamously poor with resources.
Right. Of course, we've got the Opera folks who objected to this entire PR release.
Sure.
They came out and they said, look, this is obviously just a PR buzz thing. It's not rooted in reality. In fact, Kara, if you this is the blog post that they put up, and they showed their test, and their test showed, okay, Edge is better than Chrome, but we're so much better than the other two.
Well, there's some caveats here, right? they're testing, you know, this power saver feature that they have and the way that they did their testing relies on next generation versions of the browser. A lot of background services being turned off for some reason, which Microsoft didn't do. I'm not saying Microsoft is absolutely correct. In fact, I was actually surprised the difference between Edge and Opera was so great, according to Microsoft. But the one thing Microsoft did say about this Opera mode that is correct is that it is kind of a degraded experience, right? I mean, one of the things that they're doing is turning down the quality of graphics, and they're just, you know, they're kind of giving you a less high quality view of the web, whereas Microsoft's methodology is just to present it exactly as it's intended and just do so in a more efficient fashion. So I don't know. I mean, does anyone have any strong opinions about this thing? Because I don't look at that as any kind of a smoking gun personally, but.
No, I'm absolutely with you because the way that Opera tests it is sort of the way that less scrupulous manufacturers will test their notebooks. We can give you 12 hours as long as you have the screen at minimum brightness, you have Wi-Fi off, you have power saving all the way up. It's like, well, that's not how I'm going to use it.
I always use, I always forget what it's called, but I use the example of when Windows NT got the highest possible military security standard. But in order to qualify for that, it had to be physically locked in a room with no internet connection.
And so, off. It had to be off. It was great.
Yeah.
In that Edge case, it was fantastic. Yep. Same thing with Opera. Yeah. If you're willing to turn everything off so that the browsing experience is horrific, you know what? You can get some pretty decent battery life out of it. Otherwise, it's not going to do as well as Edge.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with Opera per se, but Opera in some ways suffers from the same problems as Edge does in that it's unfamiliar to most people. And you kind of, you're like, okay, you know, I guess if the battery life was twice as much, maybe it would be worth going through the hassle of doing this. They have, you know, they have extensions and all that stuff, obviously. But yeah.
The other thing about the browser market is that it is so mature, and so many of the browsers will do whatever any other browser will do, that you have to have something really revolutionary for me to switch. I think this is back to that force of habit thing. For example, Mary Jo, Paul, how many different browsers do you have installed on the computer you're using right now?
I have two.
So Edge or IE and Chrome.
Yep.
And Paul?
Yeah, same.
Yeah, so I've got...
I was using Firefox, too, for a while, though.
Yeah, me too. And I've used Opera, and, you know, I do that kind of stuff. I mean, I test, obviously, from time to time. I don't remember which came first, but I remember when Safari came out on the Mac and it was kind of a clean and lightweight browser. I sort of said, you know, if these guys would bring this thing to Windows, I would use this. And then they did. And I was like, you know, and then, when Chrome first came out, I was instantly intrigued by Chrome because Chrome was a lot like Firefox sort of was. I mean, and the chronology of Firefox is hard to even remember. It was Phoenix and, you know, whatever came before that. I can't remember anymore, but all the permutations of it. But the notion of this, you know, again, lightweight. Remember, the point of Chrome was the web is too slow. We're gonna speed it up. And, of course, over time, Chrome itself got bogged down because it's just, you know, it's featureitis. That's the way things go. But, you know, Edge has that same thing. But, you know, now I look at it, it's like, oh, geez, I don't know if I want to. I don't know if I'm ready to do this, but. I keep trying.
Mary Jo, maybe you remember the early days of Chrome. It was so fast and it was so slick and so unbloated. And then just over the years, it's just gotten, it's become IE. It is the new IE. Everyone has it out of force of habit, even though there might be a better browser out there just because we know how to use it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do remember that. And you know, I was using pretty much exclusively IE, and then I saw more and more of my colleagues were using Chrome. So I'm like, let me try this Chrome thing. And then I was like, what am I using IE for?
Right. Yep. Exactly. Yep. The other thing about that is, so I've got Firefox installed on my laptop and my desktop, but I almost never kick it off because I know when I do, it's probably got to do an update. Like every time I turn it on, it's because I do it so infrequently. And now I just don't anymore. I'm like, well, I could click this and then, it'll update once, but then I'm not going to open it again for another 3 months, which means it's going to update again. I don't even know why it's on my laptop anymore, actually. Maybe I'll have to. Everyone in the chat room is saying I should use Dolphin or Waterfox or Pale. All the little flavors.
By the way, I think one of the other things when you choose a browser, and I think this is the reality for a lot of people, is you want something that's going to sync settings and favorites and whatever with the mobile device you're using, right? And if you're an Apple person and you use a Mac, I mean, Safari is kind of one of those obvious things, and most people probably use it without thinking or whatever, just like we did with IE, and that's fine. But if you use an Android device or an iPhone and a Windows PC, right, Chrome or Firefox make a lot of sense because that stuff happens automatically in the background. You can cut through some of that with extensions, obviously, for, you know, password saving and that kind of thing. But using Safari on an iOS device and using Internet Explorer, Edge, or something on Windows, it's like you're basically talking about two different worlds, unless you get like the Apple, you know, has an iCloud Sync app or whatever that only works with IE, not with Edge, by the way. You know, you have to really kind of work at it. And I think sometimes it's just about easing the friction. Like, I just want it to work. I mean, the nice thing about Chrome is, you know, on an Android phone or on an iPhone, Chrome is there. And all that stuff just works. If I'm looking at something on the web here, it's in my history on the phone. It's nice.
Yeah. I do that a lot for my work here on the network because I'm on my mobile a lot and I might find a couple of stories that pique my interest and they're already on my desktop. Yeah. So when I get home, I don't have to bring it back up.
To do something with it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, it's those little connections, the tie-ins between the different platforms where you go, okay, I think that's why I use it. Maybe it's not just force of habit. Chrome is the most convenient right now. If you're using more than one device and you don't like having to manually transfer over links and sites, well, that's what you do. You use
Chrome. That's Chrome, And by the way, Firefox does it too, but Chrome.
But I don't want to update it again, so it's not
good. Yep.
Wait, and by the way, any Firefox fans out there, I know it's a perfectly good browser. And actually, it might even be faster than Chrome once you consider all the Chrome bloat. But Yeah, I'm going to use Chrome. My bad. All right, let's get off of browsers because we've got some Windows Phone news. And as we all know, we are excited about any news that might happen in the Windows Phone world. Yes? Right?
Yes. We're still trying to be excited about it.
It's dead. It's not dead. Ness, it's dead. No, it's not dead. All right. So who's got this? Tap to pay.
I can start out with it. We found out this week that Microsoft is finally going to bring Tap to Pay to Windows phones, at least some Windows phones, through the new version of the wallet application that they have. So they announced this week that if you have a Lumia 950, a 950 XL, or a 650 in the US only, and you're running a Windows Insider build, what version is it?
14.360
or higher, you can now start testing this new version of wallet that supports Tap to Pay. There's a lot of caveats about this. It only currently supports a couple of banks. It supports Bank of America and People's United Bank so far. Chase and U.S. Bank and Fifth Third Bank, which I had never heard of, are on the list to come. We don't know when any banks beyond that are going to be added. We don't know when any users outside the U.S. are going to be added. And we don't know if any other Windows phones are going to be supported by the time that this becomes generally available, quote, later this summer.
Yeah.
So the exciting part is, yay, it's finally here after years of waiting. Mm-hmm. But it's coming in very slowly. And
yeah,
it's kind of weird how it's being phased in a very
casual way. I think the nice thing about this is that it doesn't require any retailer to put in special equipment. It works with the existing Tap to Pay infrastructure. It's smart. Right. I think we could kind of complain about what took so long, but let's not worry about that kind of thing.
Right.
I haven't had I was traveling yesterday. I was out yesterday and I haven't had a time to play with this yet, but I intend to do that today. The one thing I can say from using things like Android Pay or Apple Pay is that it's weird what cards work and what cards don't. And I suspect this will be the same, right? In other words, you don't need to have a card from one of the banks that's mentioned. Although I think if you want to access your debit card, you probably do. Various MasterCards and Visas will work on this system, no doubt about it. Various ones will not, and you'll never know why. And so I remember when I had a work Amex card, and we had an Amex card from Costco. I'm going to get this reversed probably, but one of them worked fine with Apple Pay and the other one didn't. They were both Amex cards, but like, you know, why? I don't,
no
because
one knows
Apple
why.
Pay, who knows? Yeah. And I think that's how this is going to work. Mm-hmm. So if you are a Windows Phone user and you have one of those phones and you're in the United States and you're running the Insider builds, and are on the Fast Ring, obviously give it a shot and see. I mean, it's kind of a nice convenience when you can walk up to a, Tap to Pay terminal, you know, in McDonald's or wherever else. And have that thing come up on your screen. And, you know, obviously a Windows phone, these Windows phones, or at least two of them have, you know, Windows Hello for security purposes. And that's kind of cool. Just like Apple has, like, or in Android phones have those fingerprint strips. So it's a pretty cool idea.
You know what I'm curious about? Is this that thing that was codenamed OnePay that we heard about over a year ago? At WinHack China, they made a big play to OEMs to support this thing called OnePay, which we all thought was Tap to Pay. And then we never heard anything about it after that. And so I'm curious, is this that?
I bet it is. But isn't it notable that only Microsoft's latest three Windows phones even support it?
Right. I actually asked them if this was going to come to HoloLens because I was thinking, you know, it would be kind of crazy. In a way to be able to use HoloLens with this. And they said, you know, we're only talking about Windows Phone right now. And we're not even talking about PCs. So
that's funny.
Yeah.
Now, I have had a few opportunities to use Android Tap to Pay, which I did it out of curiosity. But
We all do that. We never use it again.
Exactly. It's like, you know, it's when you realize, you know what? My credit card was actually pretty good. It's proven technology. Yeah, it's got a couple of flaws. In fact, the biggest problem I have with credit cards right now is because we moved over to chip and sign, which it should be chip and pin, by the way.
Please, don't get me started on this one.
It's always fun to find out which retailers actually have the insert activated. Because some of them will have the terminal with the insert, but it's not activated.
Right.
So right now, Home Depot does it. Target does it. I think some McDonald's do it, but most have not moved to that point. So, yeah.
We handle this like we handle everything in the United States, confusingly, poorly, and with multiple options, just to take something that's already an onerous enough process and make it even more complicated because the person in front of you doesn't know if they're going to stick the card in or something, you know. It's unbelievable. That's too bad.
This was one of the topics at Google I.O., and I can't remember who the speaker was, but it was a small session. And the engineer who was talking was part of the team that did NFC support for Android.
Mm-hmm.
And someone in the audience during the Q&A point asked him, when will our phones finally be able to pay for things that we want like they've been able to do in Japan for 20 years? And he said, you know what? We hear that a lot, but here's the better question. Why do we not think that payments have not advanced in the 20 years since Japan did that contact? You know, it's like we're trying to duplicate something that's already obsolete. We don't need to do that anymore. And actually, I kind of started to believe that. The most transactions that I do on my phone are not from the NFC. It's from the PayPal app that's loaded on my phone. So I don't know. I could see that, in retail, there's definitely a market for this. For the Windows phone, it's definitely not something that's going to save it. But I'm not as gung-ho on contactless payments as I used to be.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah.
I mean, part of it is just the way we spend money, too. I mean, a lot of times we're not out in a store buying a thing where we do that ordering online, you know. But this is good for, you know, there's a lot of, I mean, we could talk all day about how we make, you know, electronic payments, right? In the United States, it's still very typical to go to a restaurant, spend a couple hundred dollars with a group of people, and have the woman or a guy walk back with your card into another room, do something with it, and then come back.
That's Whereas totally secure, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in Europe, they don't, the card never leaves your sight. You're the person brings out a machine. I think I told the story on the podcast at least once before, but, you know, years and years ago when I sat down with my dad to order a Dell computer online, got to the part where he puts his credit card number and he says, whoa, what's this? I said, Dell is not going to steal your money. I said, you think nothing of handing a credit card to people in restaurants and bars all around the planet. So I said, don't worry, you don't have to worry about Dell, you know, but anyway, there's a lot going on here. But this is Windows Phone kind of finally stepping up to the bar, I guess, or the table or whatever you want to say. It's overdue.
At DEF CON last year, there was a gentleman who was selling credit card skimmers. And I just wanted to see what the state of the art of skimmers was. And he had a device that was the same size as a credit card. It looked like a credit card. You just held the credit card against it. And in 2 seconds, it had the strip. It was amazing. It was ridiculous. Wow. Like, okay.
I will never know for sure, but one year we flew, I guess, into Dublin and got money out of the machine, and we got a credit card fraud thing almost immediately. And clearly what it must have been was one of those things they put on top of the slot on the ATM machine. And, you know, especially when you fly international, ATM machines all look kind of the same, obviously. But if there was a lip on the card reader, you would never know that it wasn't part of the machine. It looked, you know, it was probably had the same color scheme, whatever. It's amazing how easy it is to steal that stuff.
I'm actually one of those people that before I use an ATM machine, I actually start pulling on the plastic pieces. I'm like, okay, are any of these?
I do.
And I put my wallet over my fingers as I'm typing in my code just so that they can't get the
pin. This is it's sort of the physical version of two-factor authentication, although obviously one part of that is physical, in the sense that you're out in the world and, you know, chip and pin. It's the thing you have and it's the thing you know. You know, it's nice that, you know, it shouldn't be enough that someone has that strip. Someone should never be able to use that without the corresponding second factor, right? The United States, I guess, banking system or the credit card companies have resisted this for years and years, just like car companies previously resisted all these safety features because it was too expensive. And, you know, congratulations. This is what we get in return. So this week on Credit Card Weekly.
I know. Maybe we're talking a little bit too much about payments, especially since it's only on 3 Windows phones that I think there's a total of 100 of in the world. So
right.
We can move. Actually, I finally got an email from, 6 months ago, I went to one of those Microsoft nights. And I saw it was when they were just launching the new flagship, the flagship Lumia. Actually, okay. It might have been longer than 6 months ago. And they had promised me a review unit. So I just got an email saying, we got one freed up. Do you want us to send it to you? I was like, thanks.
That's too bad.
I don't think I need that.
You should just say, how about a Surface phone instead?
Or a Surface. I would like a Surface. Mm-hmm. A Surface. Actually, I was very impressed with the Surface 4. I saw a, I was at, it was at Google I.O. and they had a Surface that was doing some very interesting art, public art. And I'm more sold on that concept now than I was before. Before I thought, oh, it's cool. Microsoft has a killer product, but it's not for me. Now that we've got a couple of people in the studio who have Surfaces. I could see the use case, and it's not just a weak laptop. There's definitely a unique use case.
It's not just a weak laptop. It's so much more.
When you put it that
way. Last year was just a weak laptop. This year, it's also a pretty crappy tablet.
Yeah. Oh. I was having a moment, Paul. I had a moment, and you took it away from me.
Sorry.
All right, but that's not it. We also have more Windows 10 news. And let me put a disclaimer here because people have gotten the wrong idea from some of my tweets because I've been really ticked off that I've had two machines that have auto updated to Windows 10 for some reason. And one of them did it twice.
Oh, jeez.
I actually like Windows 10. I have it on a desktop, I have it on a laptop. I do not have it on my production machines because it messes up the production tools. But I think it's a relatively decent OS. That being said, let's talk about other Windows 10 news of note.
All right.
Right. So this afternoon, right before the show started, Microsoft put out a new insider version of Windows 10 for the fast ring for PCs. It's build 14371. It's the same build number as what they put out last night for phones. But the PC version has a couple new interesting tidbits. For one, it has this thing called the Activation Troubleshooter. So you know now when people switch out their motherboards or their drives, sometimes it looks like they have a fraudulent copy of Windows 10. Their activation doesn't work correctly. Yep. This is supposed to help alleviate that situation a bit. So it looks like they're going to build this right into Windows 10. And right now you can test it if you have this brand new build. I don't know that it'll fix every issue people have with activation, but it will fix some. And for the people who have asked me this, it does not mean if you have a fake copy, it makes it a genuine copy, which I think is kind of obvious, but some people seem to think that's what this meant. No, it does not mean that.
It's a real
issue. So they're still not giving it to pirates.
They are not still giving it to pirates.
It's important to me that I be able to write a fifth article on that topic.
I know. Yeah. This does not change the piracy thing.
that they're giving it the pirate story won't die. It doesn't matter how many times we answer it. People think, oh, yeah, they're just going to give it. Microsoft's giving away their OS. It's like, well, no.
Microsoft declares amnesty for pirates. Nope.
But, okay, would that be such a bad idea?
I know.
Oh, I argued for it, actually. But I'm just saying they're not doing it. Yeah. I agree.
Yeah.
Yep. It would be better for the entire ecosystem just to get everybody up to date on the latest version of the OS. It would make it more secure for everybody.
You know,
but crime doesn't pay. See, we can't send that message.
I've got one of those little ECS. It's like a pill size computer. Mm-hmm. It was designed to run sort of a stripped down version of Windows 8. And I actually let it update to Windows 10 over the weekend. For such a low power machine, it's quite nice. I can do Netflix, YouTube, everything that you would expect. And the computer pulls 5 watts.
No.
I mean, I did not know that you could get Windows 10 into such a small footprint.
And I bet your Skype video doesn't freeze when you use it. Core i7, 16 gigs of RAM, dedicated graphics.
The problem, SSD. That's too fast. You're confusing the operating system, Paul. I had not really been following on a lot of Windows 10 news. Has there been a lot of issues with the activator shutting down on an upgrade?
The activator?
People looking like they don't have a genuine copy when they're updating. You know, I hear about it every once in a great while, but But Microsoft did change something a few months ago where they let you use your existing Windows 7 or 8.1 keys to activate. Yep. That seemed to get rid of some of the problems that people were having.
Right. But I think the thing you brought up.
I'm sorry. They're saying they still are having people with having this problem. That's why they.
Well, I think it's these. It's when you reinstall Windows 10, right? And this is the thing I was voicing a few months ago or a month or so ago when we were talking about what happens after July 29th or whenever the anniversary update comes out. You've taken a computer, you've upgraded it to Windows 10. It's working fine. Some amount of time goes by. And now you want to reinstall from scratch. So you download the ISO, install it. Technically, your product key should be up in some cloud service somewhere and it will make that connection and everything's good because you've already done the upgrade. You're genuine. You're good to go. But I've heard from many people, and in fact, and now that I'm thinking about it, this desktop computer that I'm reusing or trying to reuse had this problem months and months ago. It says, no, sorry, you're not activated. And so when you've done a clean install of the OS, originally there was no way to fix that. You know, you'd have to call Microsoft and beg them basically and say, please activate this and explain the story. And I think that that's what this is trying, the part of it. I'm sorry, obviously the other part of it would be people who upgrade the systems. You know, your motherboard fails, your hard drive fails, that kind of thing. Because the problem I've always had with this process is you're essentially going to Microsoft with your hat in your hand and saying, please, Microsoft, please listen to my story and render your judgment, you know. And I think there are still questions about what happens after July 29th, you know, around this kind of stuff. Because right now it's pretty easy. If you have the product key, you can type it in. It will work. You should be good to go. Hopefully that still works after the 29th. It seems like it would, right? But what if you hadn't already upgraded? The upgrade's only free through the 29th. So how does that work? I mean, there's a lot of questions.
Oh, yeah. I hadn't even thought of that.
Well, I mean, it's they have made it easier over time. And here's another step. Mm. And I guess the question is how this works within the anniversary update era when things are going to change again with regard to activation.
Right. They also announced today that you can now use your Microsoft account and link that to your digital license with this Insider Preview build.
Yeah. Okay. So
I can do what? So I've got Alex's tablet and it's got the preview build on this right now. Which,
and by the way, please do drop that on the table.
Leo, we need to buy another Surface. Sorry,
Alex.
No, but I have updated all of my machines at least once. I've jumped them all to 10. So that's what, 4 laptops and 5 desktops, and then promptly reverted them back to either 7 or 8. After the 29th, I've never received an activation code, but after the 29th, I should still be able to update those without having to pay, yes?
So here's the problem. This change is very interesting. In the past, and I literally mean until today, and actually including today for non-insiders, I guess, if you upgraded to Windows 10 while it was a free upgrade, like I said, some digital something occurs in some cloud something somewhere. I don't know how it works exactly, but somewhere up in the cloud, it registers your machine ID or whatever and says, this one's okay, it's good to go. That okay, that thing that's up in the cloud is for the PC. It's not associated with you. You don't own Windows. You know, the PC is the thing that has been okayed. So if you sell or give away that PC, it should always have a Windows 10 license. It shouldn't have anything to do with you. But what we're saying now is now you can link what they're calling, I guess it's called an activation digital license. There you go. That's the name.
Yeah.
With your Microsoft account, that means you're tying this to you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's really interesting because that sort of, I think, runs afoul of all of our notions about how this thing has always worked.
No, because if you look at the wording, though, it says to reactivate your genuine Windows 10 device. It has to still be the same device, even though it's you.
Okay.
Like, it can't be you on a brand new PC.
Of tying it to your...
Maybe just so that you know you have a device tied to your account? You know there's a device that is legal for Windows 10?
I mean, I'm not sure it adds anything to the... I mean, other than maybe peace of mind on behalf of the user.
So if I log into my Microsoft account right now, should I see all the devices that I've upgraded to 10? Is there a place for me to do that?
No, there isn't. Of course not. But by the way, but they do have a... See, the thing is, they do, in fact, have places on the web to see the Windows phones you have, the Xboxes you have, the Surface devices you own. There's a way to see which devices are associated with certain things like a Groove Music Pass or whatever, right? So, that kind of infrastructure is there. It's possible that this is the first step towards this. It's also possible that what this is aimed at is the post-free upgrade time frame, when, in fact, it would make sense to tie a Windows 10 license both to the machine and to the owner, right? Although I think it would still be transferable, obviously.
But only on the same device.
But then you have two sets of Windows 10 licensing.
Well, it depends on how you get it, right? So if you buy a new computer and it has Windows 10 on it, that license of Windows 10 is tied to that computer, right? I think that's I think that's pretty well understood. But if you went and bought a retail copy of Windows 10 and you installed it on an existing PC, a new PC that you built or whatever, technically you can transfer the license to that PC, to that Windows 10 license to another PC. You would have to assure Microsoft that you've deactivated it or, you know, removed it essentially from the original PC. And then you would be responsible for getting what, you know, you could put Linux on it. You could buy another copy of Windows, whatever. I guess what I'm saying is I wonder if the timing of this is because this makes more sense when everyone has to pay for Windows 10.
Yeah, it might be connected to that. You're right. That's okay. a good guess.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I'm just so accustomed to actually owning something when I buy something.
That's not how it works with Microsoft.
No.
Think differently.
And it actually hasn't worked like that for a long, long time.
Let's be
honest.
You're borrowing it.
This is the as a service era. We don't own things anymore. We subscribe to things.
Which they tell me is better because that means I always pay.
That's
my main feature, right?
Right.
It's the same reason why I'm still using Adobe CS5 because I didn't want to make the jump to 6 because I'm like, look, this works fine and I've paid for it. I own it. I can have it on all my devices versus I'm paying you a subscription every year. It's a better software, but I'm cheap.
So I do my own little cheap version of this. The funny thing is, I got to see which version. I always forget. So I use Photoshop Elements. I find it to be simpler, and the keyboard shortcuts are really easy to use. I have purchased almost every version of this software that's ever been made. I literally, within the past week, bought the latest version, which I think is 14. But, you know, of course, they have really onerous licensing, and you got to be really careful to deactivate it because you can only install it, I think, on two computers. But there's one wonderful version of Adobe Photoshop Elements, which, of course, I own. I literally own them all. I think it's 11. It's the one I save it in a folder up on my server. But if you don't update it, you could install that thing on as many computers as you want. You just got to be careful not to update the software. And I use it every single day. I use it to resize photos and, you know, for the website, whatever. And it's exactly that same thing you're describing. You know, there are newer versions. They don't really add much. I paid for this thing a million or, you know, 10 dozen times, whatever. I'm not buying any more versions of 11. But the nice thing is because I test a lot of computers and I go from machine to machine, this is the one I can just install everywhere and not worry about it. Whereas I use, you know, I'll use the latest version on my actual laptop or whatever. So I do the same thing.
Quick question from the chat room. Marsworm wanted to know if he says if he uses his Windows 7, 8 key to update to Windows 10, does that mean that that key would now be invalid? But I've never had to enter a key to get Windows 10. It just automatically installs.
I think what he means is could he then still use it for Windows 7 or Windows 8.1? Would the same key still work? I don't know. Obviously, on a machine, if you got the key off of a COA sticker or whatever on the laptop, you can still use that to install Windows 7, assuming you could find the install media or maybe you had it on the machine already. That should auto-activate. But if you're saying, could I then take that number and use it to install Windows 7 or 8.1 on a different computer?
I've never actually tried that before.
Let's say you bought a retail. Well, retail should just work, right?
I haven't had a retail copy of Windows since 7.
Yep. I don't know. That's an interesting question.
Yeah, because like most of my 7 and my 8 machines, they came with Windows on them. Mm-hmm. And that key worked for that machine. And I never, ever actually had to enter it anywhere.
Yeah. Newer PCs don't even have a sticker, right? It's just in the BIOS, it's just, essentially.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Right. And it should just work.
Yeah, that's actually an interesting question.
It's funny.
What's the rationale for it? In other words, where's the one situation where that would be legal and okay?
If you bought a retail copy of Windows for multiple PCs and it's no longer on a PC, you should technically get that license back into your pool, right?
I think retail is a different set of rules, right? Like that's the most lenient set of rules. But what if, like, say I have, like I do, Windows 7 on this machine.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to think how you would do this. But that wouldn't make sense. I was going to say, I have Windows 10 on the other, but no.
It's lenient in the sense that you can transfer the license.
Right. But if you have a retail copy.
Yes. But what we're describing is a situation where you're reusing the license. So you're using it twice. Right. Once for Windows 7, once for Windows 10. I can't imagine that Microsoft allows that. I guess the question is whether you would get away with it. Mm-hmm. And I bet you would. Honestly, I don't know that, but it wouldn't surprise me if you could get away with that. I've never tried it, obviously.
Yeah, because legally, if you got a free copy of Windows 10, you're saying I have a copy of Windows 7 or 8 that it goes on top of. You can't then
computer.
Take it away.
Yeah, you can't say I have Windows 7 over here, thus I get it for free over here. Right. You know, you can't.
It's tied to the machine.
I guess a best case scenario is that product key with that machine ID and Windows 7 would work over there. That same product key with another machine ID and Windows 10 might work over there. It's possible those would work at the same time. Mm. Probably should associate that one with your Microsoft account. I'm just throwing that one out there, but I don't know if that would work or not.
Couldn't hurt.
Yeah.
No, I'm the same way. I think most of the machines that I've had that had 8 and then updated to 10, you don't have media with them. You don't have a key with them, and it's tied to that machine. I can order the disk. I can pay extra and get the disks were supposed to come with the box, but I could never install that on another machine. It's tied to that machine.
Oh, no. I in most instances, 90-something percent plus, this is not going to be an issue for anyone because most people are using a computer. They upgrade it. We don't think about these things. I guess I'm trying to think through what would be the case where you would have a product key for some previous version of Windows. You've used it somewhere and then upgraded that computer to Windows 10, it activated, and now you want to take that product key and move it over to a different computer.
Like a system builder, a home builder.
I mean, system builder, a little dicey, but it's probably doable. A retail key, I think, would be doable. That seems like the most, the biggest possibility for success, I guess. I guess it would depend. It would be an expensive thing to test. You know, you have to buy a bunch of retail keys.
Leo!
They're not cheap.
No, they're not. It's actually cheaper to buy that ECS Windows 8 machine and update it to 10 than to buy a retail copy of 7 or 8 and then you upgrade to 10. Go figure.
That's funny. I'll have to look. I haven't looked at this activation troubleshooting thing yet either. I'll have to look at this stuff.
It's going to become more important. We're getting really close to that deadline, which was it was theoretical when we heard about it. We're like, okay, you've got a year. Now you've got a month. You've got a month to figure out what you're going to do. And none of us knows how strict Microsoft is going to be after the 29th.
Mm. Yeah. Well, so this appears to address that hardware change thing, which I think was the biggest issue with reactivation. The second biggest, at least from my experience, has literally been you activate it successfully, reinstall Windows, and it's like, nope. You know, and now you're like, now you're just kind of stuck. Although I think they, by bringing in Windows 7, 8, 1 keys, they semi-address that. So
now if Microsoft was smart, they would hit the 29th, they would cut everybody off, and then like a couple of weeks later, they'll say, you know what? We're going to give you an extra month.
Sure.
And now that nag screen doesn't seem so naggy, does it?
Let's silently leave it working on the back end and not tell anybody.
Passive-aggressive. Passive-aggressive Microsoft.
It's the Microsoft way.
I think the July 29th thing, I think is, that's that.
Yeah.
That's that?
Yep.
Yeah.
All right. Actually, a good question from Cool Breeze to either Paul or Mary Jo, who wants to know if you have a sense of how the licenses for 10 are handled for virtual machines?
Oh, I don't believe they have any specific change for that. In other words, if you were running a virtual machine on a non-Windows 10 machine, what would you have to do to get Windows 10 in a virtual machine? You would have to buy a license to Windows 10. If you're running Windows 10 on a Windows 10 machine, does that license from the physical machine transfer to one virtual machine? I actually don't know the answer to that question, but I don't believe it does. You know, if you threw Hyper-V on there and install Windows 10, would it take the product key from the underlying machine and activate? I would guess no.
Do you know, do either of you have any experience with Windows 10 phoning home from a VM to say, hey, oh, there's multiple instances of me running right now?
That would be the other issue, right? Of course, you have multiple. Well, I don't know. You know, they're not completely identical, but nearly identical machines with the same product key. I don't know.
I mean, we could find out.
Yeah. If only there were a way.
If only there were a way for me to turn on that VM cluster I have at home and spin up a few Windows 10 machines.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, there is. I can do that. But as far as I know, I've always played it straight with licensing. And you're supposed to have a license for every VM OS that you spin up. So, you aren't supposed to spin up multiple copies of the same thing unless you have that paper that says I have 10 licenses, which I don't for 10. So
I'm sorry. Yeah, I don't know. That's something I'm going to look into this now. I'm curious about that one.
Well, you know, we're going to come back in just a bit. We need to talk about the Surface because the Surface is getting a firmware update. And Paul, I know you're all about this Surface, especially Alex is here because I think it's done updating. It may have finished the preview build. But before we get to that, I do want to thank another sponsor because they are one that I hold near and dear to my heart. I actually own their product before they ever came onto the Twit TV network. And this is what it is. It's the Ring Video Doorbell. Now, inside this kit, you'll find everything you need to install the Ring Video Doorbell. That includes the tools, the bit, even the level so that you can get it nice and straight. This is the hardware itself. Now, this is a doorbell. I mean, that's what's in the name. They push the button, you get a nice tone, it tells you that there's someone at your front door. But that's not all it does. You see, this is also a communications device, a two-way communications device. There's a motion sensor up top, and then this is a high-definition camera that allows you to connect to your Ring Video Doorbell from anywhere in the world through your smart device. Now, here's how it works. I bought one of these for my parents because I was always a little bit worried about how their neighborhood was going. You see, they live in a semi-retired community, and there are people who will stop by and look through the windows, ring the doorbell to find out if somebody's home. Well, with the Ring Video Doorbell, the minute that they walk into that front porch, they're being recorded. And with Ring's cloud service, that video gets automatically uploaded to the cloud, so they couldn't just steal the doorbell and walk away with the proof. Not only that, if someone comes to the door, I can actually start a two-way conversation. I can say, hey, how you doing? What do you need? And I can tell the UPS person to leave a box in a special spot on the foyer. I could tell the delivery person who's got a special delivery for me that they should go around the side because I'm going to open up the door electronically. The Ring Video Doorbell is possibly the coolest device I've ever bought for my parents. And guess what? It gets even better because right now Ring is upgrading their offering to the Ring of Security Kit. Now, the kit includes a Ring Video Doorbell for the front door and a Ring Stick-Up Cam, a wireless weatherproof HD camera to keep an eye on other parts of your property. And, of course, with that cloud video recording, it means that you can now easily capture and share your video with your friends, your family, or, worst-case scenario, with law enforcement. The kit also includes a solar panel and a chime. Anyone who's been wondering about installing this in a hard-to-reach area that doesn't have wiring or doesn't have regular access to, say, a USB charging for the device, you can now buy a security kit and be completely, completely wireless. Now, the Ring Video Doorbell and Stick-Up Cam installs in just minutes. Working together, they can provide you 24/7 monitoring of your entire home, whether you're in the living room or thousands of miles away. So here's what we want you to do. We want you to try the device that is one of the best gadgets that I've ever had in my lab. Join the hundreds of thousands who protect their home with Ring. Now, for a limited time, Windows Weekly listeners can save $50 off one of their Ring of Security kits, the bundle kit or the pro bundle kit. Just go to ring.com/WW and take advantage of the lowest price anywhere. Again, that's ring, ring.com/WW. And we thank Ring for their support of Windows Weekly. Oh, Paul, the Surface is getting a firmware update that's going to make it just perfect, right? It's going to fix everything.
Yep. Yeah, they, you know, back in January, Microsoft finally fixed the big Surface Book and Surface Pro 4 firmware issues, right, where they weren't sleeping properly. And mine has worked fine ever since, but I took my Surface Book to Colorado earlier this month. It seemed like it was months ago, but anyway, a week ago. And it actually turned off in the middle of the night twice on me. I had, you know, you just close it to put it to sleep. I had a bunch of tabs open, documents open in applications. Turn it on, and you can tell, you open it up, it doesn't come back to life. You hit the power button, logo comes up, kind of takes a second, and you're like, this thing's booting up from scratch, isn't it? And yep, sure enough. And I let it happen to me twice, so that shows you how smart I am. But they have been, I guess, this, it sounds like they're addressing this issue in this month's update. And so one of the fixes they have for both Surface Book and Surface Pro 4 describes improving system stability when the device resumes operation from sleep or hibernation. And another one reduces the occurrence of unexpected shutdowns while the device is sleeping. Eek. You know, so that one is Surface Book specific. So hopefully this one will do it. I had this problem. And we'll see what happens.
But now, when you say it shut down, do you mean you put it to sleep and then it went all the way off, or it just turned off in the middle of a session?
No, I put it to sleep and it turned off. Huh. Mary Jo has a problem where she uses her computer and it just turns off while she's using it. Mine, it turns off when it's sleeping. So, yeah.
So, wait, Mary Jo, so you'll be typing and then does it go into the shutdown or does it just turn off?
Just turns off. But wow. You know what? I was going to talk to you about this, actually. It's the Acer S7 that's doing this.
With Windows 10.
And I looked, I was saying on last week's episode, I looked this up and it said something about the screws needed to be tightened. Like a lot of people have reported this. And if the screws are loose and you're not plugged in, it automatically shuts itself off as a precaution.
Not the type of feedback you want to hear on a computer.
No.
This is one of the original S7s. I have never had a screw loose. Well,
I've tightened my screws twice now.
Opinions vary.
Wait, so your screws are actually working out. So you have to tighten them up every once in a while?
Well, I didn't know I had to, but now I have. And it seems maybe it's fixed, but maybe not.
That's amazing.
Not
100%. You know how Surface Book has a pen that magnetically attaches to the side of the screen? Mm-hmm. Hers has a Torque screwdriver that magnetically attaches to the side of the screen.
Okay, wait, hold, Mayor Joe, when you say it shuts down, does it, when you bring it back up, does it have to boot from cold or does it?
Like, yeah.
Oh, really? Because there is something that happens with this, because I've actually got two of these. I remember.
Who doesn't?
Yeah, right? You can just carry on, too.
Yeah.
They only weigh 2 pounds. I mean, come on. But I at one point, I had one on top of the other. So I had the one down below. And the one on top kept shutting down. I was like, what's going on? And I found out that the magnets in the lid were strong enough to affect the sensor in the laptop on top. Oh, wow. And it was putting it to sleep.
Wow.
Of course, that's not yours. I mean, if yours is going cold, so yeah.
No, I brought mine to the Microsoft store. They ran every imaginable test on this thing, and they said, your computer has no issue. I don't know why it's shutting down. We can't figure it out.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll have to fix that. I can't have you using a faulty S7. That's just wrong.
No. Yep. Well, luckily, Paul and I both are testing a new PC.
Yes. It's kind of sexy. Tell me about this HP.
Yeah, this is pretty nice. It's just called the Spectre, I believe, right?
Yeah. This is one thing that they really scrub. Technically, it's a Spectre 13T.
Oh, I like that.
Which is a name that's already been used on another computer. So, you know, whatever.
Oh really?
It's the new Spectre.
It's really, really, really thin. Thinner than a MacBook.
Wait, hold that up again. Is that thinner than the S7?
Yes. It is thinner than the S7.
So, the world's
thinnest laptop.
Oh, hey, look. I'm in the club too now.
You have one too.
Well, no.
Yeah.
Leo does. This, wow. Okay, you got my attention. How do you like this?
So I've only been trying it out for about 3 days, and so far I like it a lot. My only complaint so far is battery life is so-so.
Ooh.
Maybe like five and a half hours.
No. And is that with power savings turned on, or is that just running it flat out?
That's with power savings turned on.
Five and a half, no.
No. It should be better than that. I used it all day yesterday, and I didn't
you
get...
You didn't have an issue?
No. I was probably in a 6 hour range, somewhere in there. Mm. And not oddly, but before the show, I actually opened it up to transfer something off of it. And it said battery was at 12% or something like that. It was pretty low.
I like the feel of the keyboard. It's got a little.
Yeah, the keyboard actually surprised me.
Excellent.
Yeah. It looks small, but it really.
And the trackpad is tiny, right?
Yeah, it is, right?
But I found it really okay so far.
Yeah. I prefer small trackpads, frankly, but.
I like the offset trackpads. I don't like what's in the middle because I tend to do that.
Yeah. Well, but by the way, that's another thing that's really nice about this. Using that all day long to take notes yesterday, I never once did that thing I do on a lot of machines, including some HPs, where some palm press will send the cursor, you know, moving off to somewhere else and the text starts appearing somewhere else. I didn't have a mistype like that once. And that's actually pretty notable.
Yeah. No, I really like the feel of this keyboard. I got used to the keyboard on an S7, even though it's not the best, but they definitely improved it. This I like.
Yeah, it's a good one.
It's got to be lighter than the S7. So USB-C, it's got two USB 3 ports
Three USB-C. Two of them are Thunderbolt.
Right, Thunderbolt. Mm. Combo audio port. No card reader. That's new.
Yeah, it's all USB-C.
10-point multi-touch. This is a decent laptop.
No. There's no multi-touch, actually.
Oh, there's
no touch? Which is kind of awesome, guys.
Really?
Well, you know what, though? Okay, so here's the thing. I agree with Mary Jo that a lot of times, you know, you work on the machine, you don't really need touch. But the problem is, if you've used touch, I touch the screen all the time on this thing.
Yep.
And I'll touch the screen to hit a button on a window to close the window, to scroll a page. You sort of don't realize how much you use it until it's not there.
Yeah, agree.
And I think you get used to it. And I think most people use one computer and they don't really run into this kind of thing. But
yeah, no, and you know what? You saw me. I don't use touch a lot on the Acer. I almost always used to connect a mouse to it. And I did find myself reaching out to touch the HP a couple times. But after like a day, I pretty much have stopped doing that.
Yeah. And it's unlike any Surface device. Well, the Surface Book's pretty good. It's lappable, even on my tiny upper legs.
It's very lappable.
It works really well.
Now, I used to be with Mary Jo in that I always thought, okay, touch is kind of a gimmick. It's a cool demo thing, but I couldn't see myself using it on a regular basis. But with this S7, I'm like Paul now, where every once in a while, there's just something I will naturally reach out and touch the screen. It's just easier to do it that way.
Yeah.
And I hate to say it, but I fell for the gimmick. I'm sorry.
It's good for your triceps.
Yeah.
I don't really think touch is a gimmick. I think there are some people who, you know, especially if they use their machine both as a tablet and a laptop, there's a reason to have touch, obviously. Yeah. But I think for many business users, they just don't need it and they don't want it. Like a lot of people don't want to mess up their screen by having fingerprints on it. But if you connect a mouse to it, there's just really not a lot of reason to use touch.
Here's the thing, though. This is not a touchscreen laptop, but you will still get fingerprints because you will type and then you close the screen. And when you bring it back up, it will have oil on the screen. So
if you want to really see the fingerprints, look at the copper bit at the back, like close the laptop.
That is a fingerprint magnet. Can you get this, Kara? You go. See? And that was clean when it was handed to me. So I have really greasy fingers.
Well, regardless. No, it's not you. I mean, I talked to HP about that and it smudges if you cough in the room. I mean, it's really bad, but that's the nature of this kind of high end, almost like jewelry type finish, you know?
Oh, and by the way, people were asking if it was a Thunderbolt combo audio port. No, this is standard audio. That's a 3.5 inch combo jack. And then you've got power. And then you've got the two USB-C Thunderbolt ports.
Yep.
That's not... Mm-hmm. Okay, what's the price on this?
I think it's $11.49 for the base config, which is not terrible. It's, and by the way, this is a Core i5 machine. It's not a Core M. And that's one of the things that makes it really special. They didn't go lowball in the processor.
Core i5 and non-touchscreen.
Yep.
And it's screaming fast with Notepad, guys. I know you have that question, but yes.
Yep.
No, actually, it's really fast with a lot of things that I tested it with. And the browser responsiveness on it is great. I've tried it with Chrome. I've tried it with Edge.
Have either of you tried the Razer Stealth Blade or Blade Stealth?
No.
Is this the gaming laptop?
Gaming laptop. So it's an 2.75-pound Ultrabook. Not as thin as this, but has a larger screen, 10-point multi-touch, can do 4K, Core i7, 8 gigabytes of memory, 128, 256, or 512, a PCI connected, not SATA connected, SSD.
Yep. This one is also PCIe. Yeah.
$1,000. Starts at $1,000. But then the cool part is you get the core. And the core is, it looks like a shoebox enclosure.
This is the dedicated graphics thing.
Yes, you can put a desktop graphics card into it. Plus, it's got USB 3 in the back. So you have your power connected to the core, plus your peripherals, one cable to the notebook, and it's power connected.
Is it USB-C?
Everything. USB-C Thunderbolt.
Yeah, that's good. No, I've not tried that. That sounds interesting, though.
It's thicker. It's not as sexy as this HP, but it's all aluminum. And it's Razer, so it's kind of sexy. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
I like the idea. Mm-hmm. My problem is machine you've got, the Acer. I've been using 14 or even 15-inch Ultrabooks for so long. Going to a 13, it's like this. It seems like it's this tiny little screen. You know, like everything has to be full screen, and you know, it's cute. Yeah.
That's why I always carry around. I have a 15-inch USB 3 monitor. This thing actually is incredible. It's probably one of my favorite purchases ever.
Right.
I get my dual screen when I'm on the go.
Nice.
Yeah. It's hard for me to use a smaller screen, though. But I think this is the mainstream. I think most people have 13-inch.
Mary Jo, how big is your screen?
On the Acer, it's 13. On this desktop I'm using right now, it's 21.
Damn, we've gotten spoiled. We need big screens and a lot of them.
I need a smaller screen. I got such a big screen on my desktop. It's why I'm all washed out. There's so much light pouring off of this thing.
You still have that big giant surround.
It's unbelievable. This was such a mistake.
Wait, is it a TV you're using as a monitor, or is it a huge
No, it's an HP display. It's a 32-inch display, and it just throws off the light of 1,000 suns. I think I'm getting sunburned just doing the podcast.
Might be. That's why you look tan.
Yes, that's right. I never actually go outside. It's from sitting in front of this thing. There's like a shadow behind me on the wall, like from an X-ray.
Well, Leo's got a brand new 37-inch. Is it 37-inch, Jammer B? How big is that thing? It's a 47-inch Dell monitor, and you can do four different inputs. It's kind of nice.
Yes. Yeah, actually, I can do that on this screen, too, but these would be small.
And we could do Skypezilla with just one screen.
Mm-hmm.
Go figure.
Yep.
All right, let's move off of Windows news, because we've got a couple of items on the iOS front, and kind of interesting, because this is Microsoft's whole strategy of just get it out there, get onto every platform, get into the hearts of everybody. They're essentially trying to pull out the old Apple playbook of getting you while you're young, getting you often, and then getting you stuck in their ecosystem.
By the way, before we get to the specifics, I would like to know when Microsoft guys will stop complaining when Microsoft put apps on other platforms.
Never.
I can't write about one of these topics. Yep. No, seriously, without hearing from someone on Twitter usually, I don't understand why they didn't put this on Windows 10 first.
Because, I don't think we're going to see this in our lifetime, Paul. Sorry.
Okay. All right.
It's just another thing to complain about.
Yeah. It is.
the complete comment is, I don't understand why they didn't have this on Windows 10 first, even though I probably would not have downloaded or used it.
Especially Windows Phone, you know, Windows 10 Mobile, you know, they should support their own platform first.
Right. But SharePoint. SharePoint's the first one, right?
Right. So SharePoint, in May, Microsoft said they were going to come out with some mobile SharePoint apps that you could use on your phone to access your SharePoint online or your SharePoint on-prem servers. So, of course, the first version that came out was for iOS. It came out this week. And it looks like a really nice app. And I just like Paul just said, as soon as I wrote about it and posted to Twitter, a bunch of people were like, wow, I can't believe they didn't do this for Windows Phone first. And my response was, if you looked at how many people at Microsoft now are using iPhones, it kind of makes sense that they did this for the iPhone first.
Yeah,
this lets you access all your files, your people, your team sites, your portals, all through this app that's on iPhone. It also runs on the iPad. And Microsoft did say that later this year they will have versions for Android and a Windows Universal version that should work on Windows Phone, I would think, and also Windows 10. So it's coming. It's just not there yet.
Yep. SharePoint tends to be a bit more business-oriented. It's a bit more enterprise-y than the other tools. Is there a lot of iOS enterprise users who needed SharePoint?
I think it's more SharePoint? A case of people who are business users who have SharePoint servers or SharePoint Online may have iPhones as their personal and or work device, and they just want to be able to access those files.
Yep.
Okay, I could see that. It's not a huge market, though.
I don't know. You know, I think you'd be surprised, to be honest.
I do, too.
I think the BYOD thing has been huge in all businesses, and I think in what I see is the dying breed of businesses that are determined to control what their employees get, the number one phone is still an iPhone, at least in the United States. I mean, I think you have to kind of go where the users are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I mean, BYOD, I remember it was the third episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech 4 years ago, and we really started talking BYOD, and it was still a relatively new term, and people didn't really understand what it meant. And it's become BYOD means I'm using my iPad. That's basically what BYOD has become for most IT departments.
You know, if you think like 15 years of IT, the past 15 years, right? We've gone from enterprises super gluing USB ports so people can't plug in devices to it's like a conga line of whatever you want. It's like it really has just turned into a completely different world than it was before. So. Yeah. Good and bad. Obviously.
Well, that was the death of perimeter security. That was the whole, well, once you're inside the castle gates, you should have access to everything. And we don't do that anymore. Well, we shouldn't do that anymore.
Yeah, sure.
Unfortunately, we still do that. And that's why we have breaches.
Well, I think there's still the notion of different levels of permissions. If it's a BYOD situation, maybe you get email. And if it's a corporate controlled device, you know, maybe you get SharePoint and, you know, you can kind of still do it in degrees. Nobody should ever have full access, I guess. But.
Well, that's SharePoint. Paul, what's Flow Event Automation?
So it's not a new version of the Flow keyboard, right? Microsoft has a Word Flow keyboard as well for iOS. If you're familiar with IFTTT, if this, then that, which is kind of a cool way to automate workflows between different cloud services, this is Microsoft's version of that. And so two or more cloud services. Microsoft has some great examples, like the boss emails you. You know, if the boss emails you, then send a text message alerting you to this fact so you can make sure you see the message, that kind of thing. They launched Flow, I think, 2 months ago on the web. They support a bunch of services, over 40, Office 365, Twitter, OneDrive, Dropbox, Google Drive, SharePoint, obviously, MailChimp, and many others. The iOS version is the first version for mobile, so it's a mobile app version of the service, like SharePoint. It's not exactly like SharePoint. They promised a version for Android, actually. They haven't said anything about Windows Phone or Windows Universal app. But if you're on Windows 10, obviously, you can use the web version. The other caveat here is that the version for iOS that just shipped, this mobile app version, is not actually the full product. You can't create flows, which is what they call these workflows, in the app. You can create them on the web, and then you can see if I got manage them, track them, explore, whatever explore means, manage and track them. You can, you know, go in and view the various steps in each flow, and you can turn them on or off on the go. And so eventually, obviously, the mobile app will be upgraded to support the full functionality, but this is just the first release.
Well, they've got a lot of partners here and some big names, everything from OneDrive, Dropbox, Slack, GitHub. All right, I can see that.
There's a naming thing occurring here that's kind of interesting. I think like Flow, like Sway, like Groove. It's kind of a it's kind of an interesting, you know, really short kind of
snappy verbs.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you. It's like you're a writer or something.
Hey, it's better than like Windows Server 2012 R2 Service Pack 1.
It's so much better. You know, OneDrive for business.
Yeah. I could see myself getting addicted to something like this, to set up all these different flows.
Absolutely. Yeah. You could be really, you know, just as a journalist, I mean, you could set up, if something gets tweeted a lot, send me an alert, you know, or, you know, if you're looking for certain blogs are updated, I want to know about that no matter where I am, you know, send me a text message, that kind of thing. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff. You could go nuts with this.
It has YouTube integration, so I could set it up so every time a new video pops up, it just logs in and types first.
Shitting on a surfboard. Alert.
You're that guy, aren't you?
I am that guy. Congratulations. Yep. You have met that guy. He is me.
Yeah.
All right. Now, this is something that I'm really looking forward to. I saw this in the rundown. I got excited.
Sorry. You're referring, of course, to Mary Jo's payback for the Xbox sequence.
Yes. So we had our fun with gaming. Yep. Now let's talk enterprisey stuff. VMs and Docker. Mary Jo. Yeah. What do we got?
Okay, so this week it was DockerCon in Seattle, of all places.
Isn't that a song from the 80s?
Should be.
It sounds like it should be, yeah.
DockerCon, DockerCon.
DockerCon is not the entertainment.
I was totally off the rails. No, it's serious business. DockerCon,
serious,
let's go.
Serious, guys, serious. It was so serious that one of the keynoters at DockerCon was Mark Rusinovich, who is the chief technology officer of Azure. And he made a couple of very interesting points during his keynote. And one of them that I thought was the most interesting was how many Azure virtual machines are now running Linux. Up till this week, the stat that Microsoft always threw out there was 1 out of every 4 of our VMs are running Linux, which is huge. This week, it's 1 of every 3. He said during the keynote, this just happened within the past year. So if you ever wonder why Microsoft keeps saying they love Linux, this is why. They're really doing, it seems, quite well with Linux in their own cloud. And then he made a bunch of other announcements at Docker where he talked about some of the things they have, like Azure Container Service, and how that now is going to support Windows Server. Up till this point, that's only been supporting Linux, which is very interesting. Another big announcement there was that there are now Docker betas available for both Azure and for Windows 10. So if you have Hyper-V in Windows 10, you can now run Docker right in your Windows 10 client.
Oh, Mary Jo.
So yeah, there was quite a bit of Microsoft news. Oh, and they did announce also betas for AWS and Mac, but who cares?
It's Azure.
That's another show. That's not this show.
Yeah, exactly. No, we're not giving them any press. No. Mary Jo, maybe you can help me on this, because I, several times on multiple shows, I've tried to explain the difference between VMs and containers to people who think that they're the same thing. And it doesn't matter how many times I say, look, when you think of a VM, it's sort of a heavy container. You're wrapping an OS that has services built into it, whereas with a container, with a Docker container, you're wrapping just the service. Is there a better way to explain it so that people stop asking me that question?
I know. I mean, they're not totally mutually exclusive things, but when Docker talks about containers, they say Docker uses containers instead of virtual machines. And what it does is let you run multiple applications at once on the same server. So that's kind of how they explain what they do. They also announced this week that orchestration is now built directly into Docker. So the Docker platform is getting more comprehensive and more capable. And Microsoft's tied very tightly at the hip with Docker. They're doing all kinds of things with them with Windows Server and Linux and Azure. So you're going to hear a lot more about what Microsoft's doing there. I could tell you just like a personal anecdote that I have a bunch of friends here in New York in IT. And we were actually on a beer field trip, which we do sometimes here. And all they wanted to talk about, usually it's all about the beer on the beer field trip. Though when I was on the most recent one with them, it was all about containers. All they wanted to talk about were containers. So it's something that if you're a developer or somebody in IT, it's very much I know some people think it's a buzzword, but it's very much kind of topic du jour. And Microsoft's right there, hand in hand with Docker. In fact, some people think Microsoft should buy Docker. You hear that mentioned often. Like, why don't they just buy Docker before Google buys it? Yeah. Well, just like Citrix, yeah. I haven't heard that they're even thinking about that or doing that, but that just shows you how tightly they're tied in with them in this whole container space.
I love Docker. I have Synology NAS boxes that I can run Docker on top of, which is, I love that. I love the fact that I can just throw a container up. It'll be running in the background. I will say, though, it's not quite security ready. When you compare the security that you can get out of a VM versus the security that you can get out of a container, there's still a couple of things that Docker needs to fix before it becomes a full-blown enterprise solution. Where everyone will run containers rather than VMs. But we'll see. Now, back to that number. So 1 in 3 on Azure is running Linux. Yep. That's the number we have right now.
You know, Azure is both platform as a service and infrastructure as a service. So on the infrastructure as a service side, where you can have either Windows Server or Linux running a virtual machine, every one out of every three of those is Linux now, and the other two-thirds, obviously, Windows Server. Not the reverse, but it's kind of like a huge number when you think this is Microsoft's cloud, and of course, everybody's going to be running Windows Server in a VM.
I'm just thinking of the last data closet that I set up, we had probably about 40 VMs running. And only 4 of them were running Microsoft servers. Everything else was Linux.
It was, yeah.
Yeah. We had an Exchange server running. We had the AD server running. Actually, we had 2 in that little forest of AD servers. And then we had a Microsoft storage server. And every other instance, every other VM was a Linux image.
Wow.
So, I could believe it. It's hard to believe that up in Azure, Linux has that much penetration. But, okay, I'll go with it.
Yeah.
Was it good? Did you actually went to DockerCon?
I didn't go. I was kind of covering it from afar, but there seemed to be a lot of excitement just because containers are the thing and it's Docker. And it's cool it was in Seattle because that, you know, there's where your two biggest cloud companies are, Amazon and Microsoft.
Have you played with the built-in ability of Windows 10 to use VMs at all?
I have not.
Not yet? I keep promising I'm going to do it, and I just... I need to dedicate like a weekend to do it properly.
Then you can put Docker on your Windows 10 machine.
Yes, yes. So if you want to play with containers, now is the time to upgrade to Windows 10. Again, see that nag screen was right. You're going to love it.
Yep.
And that's why Paul updates, because he wants containers.
He does.
And Bash.
And Bash, right. Don't forget that.
All right. When we come back, we're going to be able to jump into hopefully a little bit of listener Q&A, although we've been getting it throughout the show. And then we've got tips and picks. But first, I've got some exciting news for the folks out there who are looking for a mortgage. Now, I know that when you all think of mortgages, you think of the most fun you could ever have, right? I mean, what's more entertaining than going to a bank hat in hand with paperwork from the last 20 years of your business or your personal finances and then begging for the money to buy a home, you know, not a car, not a vacation, but a roof over your head. We all know that that's a wonderful time of life. Of course it's not. It's horrible. Everybody hates doing it. Mortgages are one of the most stressful things that a modern adult will have to do because you're negotiating something that will be over you for the next 20, 30, 40 years. Well, folks, if you do like that, if you're one of those rare people who enjoys pain, enjoys inconvenience, enjoys being uncomfortable, maybe even a little embarrassed, then by all means, please continue to do mortgages the old-fashioned way. But if not, if you're a member of the new generation, if you believe that things should be done online, if you want an easy way to get your mortgage right now, then you need to try Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com. Now, Rocket Mortgage is a new way of thinking about your finances. It brings the mortgage approval process into the 21st century. It's fast, it's powerful, and it's completely online. They've taken all of the complicated, time-consuming guesswork parts of applying for a mortgage out of that equation. If you hate searching through stacks of old files and paperwork, well, don't. With Rocket Mortgage, you can easily share your bank statements and pay stubs at the touch of a button rather than going through your old file-a-flow. It can help you get approved in minutes for a custom mortgage solution that's been tailored to your unique financial situation. This is not you going into a bank and saying, I'll take choice A or choice C. This is Rocket Mortgage working with you saying, look, what can you pay? How much can you put up? And what are you looking to borrow? It's really that simple. Even better, with Rocket Mortgage, you can do all of this on your phone or your tablet. You're never really that far from financial freedom. It's a quick online process that you can manage from the convenience of your couch. So if you're looking to refinance your mortgage or buy a home, you owe it to yourself to check out Rocket Mortgage today at quickenloans.com/windows. That's quickenloans.com/windows. Equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of Windows Weekly. All right, I always forget, how does the listener Q&A work? Do we actually have a list that we've been asked, or should I have been paying attention?
Yeah, we just say chat room, or anyone listening who wants to throw out a question on Twitter, go ahead.
Yeah, you can do that over the next couple of minutes. Of course, we have answered some fantastic questions about activation, about licensing. But if you've got anything else that you need from these two wonderful people, hit me up, Twitter, Padre Estre, or here in the chat room at irc.twit.tv. Until then, I think we've got tips and picks. Who's first?
We do.
Paul? Guess I'm up. So with this week's news about Edge battery life improvements over competing browsers and the pending release of the anniversary update, people who are on Windows 10 might want to consider moving to Microsoft Edge. I mean, I recommend at least experimenting with it. As we discussed earlier, it's a little different and it can be a little strange, but there's no reason you can't kind of load the thing up and give it a shot. I mean, so a couple of things you might want to consider is first, if you're not on the insider builds, you might want to wait for the anniversary update. There are major changes coming to Microsoft Edge. The big things, like extensions and Cortana improvements and so forth, but lots of small things too. A lot of the personalization features are a lot nicer than they were in the original shipping version. So something to look forward to. At that point, just trying to think out, obviously you should spend a lot of time in settings, customizing it and so forth. It supports a dark and a light color scheme that's kind of separate from the OS color scheme. How you want to handle favorites, favorites bar or not, and all that kind of stuff. You should import your favorites. You can import from Chrome and from Internet Explorer only. So if you're using, Opera or Firefox, you're going to have to export first, maybe to another browser. And then I think the biggest one, and the thing that might put Edge over the top for most people, is just to take a look at the extensions. There are some obvious ones you're going to want to look at, like AdBlock or AdBlock Plus. LastPass for password management. Microsoft has an excellent translator add-in you can do to automatically translate web pages that are written in other languages. I use the Get Pocket extension. I use the Pocket service, and I like that quite a bit. But, that's a situation that's going to improve over time as well. Right now, there's probably about a dozen extensions. But as this thing heads toward the final release, and it's kind of a wide-open market, I think we're going to see a much bigger collection of extensions out in the store. So it's a process. I mean, you might ultimately decide not to, but I think, like we discussed earlier, there are things that do put Edge over the top, especially the performance, the scrolling, and the really nice text and graphics rendering. So something to take a look at.
I think maybe that could be homework for our audience. Go home, hour. Spend an hour with Edge.
Let me know how that goes.
Yeah.
So for the past month or so, I've been doing what we call the App Raisin mobile app pick of the week. This is an ad duplex app called App Raisin, where people on the Windows 10 platform, mobile or PC, can upvote mobile apps and mobile app updates. And I take a look at what the most popular stuff is from the week, and I make a pick from that. I'm picking one this week that was just announced because it's such a big deal and it's so important to the Windows platform, which is the Windows 10 Maps app. It's the thing that's just called Maps if you have Windows 10 or Windows 10 Mobile. This is particularly important on mobile, I think, although there are obviously some cross-platform benefits as well to using it in both. But the reason being that the Here Maps apps, and there were, I'm sorry, I should say the Here apps, it was Here Maps, Here Drive and Drive Plus, City Lens, and Here Transit, were such a big part of the DNA of Windows Phone for, 4 or 5 years there. When Nokia came on board, one of the big benefits they brought with them was their apps and services expertise, and the Here stuff was a big part of that. Nokia did not sell here to Microsoft, inexplicably, when they sold the rest of it to Microsoft or the rest of the good stuff. And then about a year later, they did sell it off. And now here is a standalone entity. And back in January, maybe, I think they announced that they were no longer going to support Windows Phone. And so as of June 30th, next week, these apps are going away on Windows. And if you have a Windows Phone 8 device, you'll still be able to use the apps. If you have a Windows 10 mobile device, you will not. And so we need to look at other alternatives. And Microsoft has one. It's the Windows 10 Map app. It's the thing that's built into Windows 10. And in January, when HERE made those announcements, the Windows 10 Map app was really shoddy. It was terrible. But not long thereafter, they made a big announcement. They made a big update to the app. And this week, they made another huge update. And it's kind of getting there. And so, for people on Windows phones, especially with the latest version, Windows 10 Mobile, this is a really big deal because the navigation experience in this app is actually really high quality. And they've improved that again in this update. So you'll get this. If you have Windows 10 Maps as part of the system, you're going to get this whether you want it or not. But you do want it. The truth is it's a pretty good app now. And this is another big update. So something to look forward to.
Have you tried it with turn by turn? I've seen some people saying it's iffy.
Yeah, it's okay. So it is turn by turn is the way I would say it. And it works. Windows Phone has a rough history with this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I should have used it yesterday. I didn't think of that. I just tested it. No, I haven't tested it since this new update, I should say. I tested it recently, though. It's not horrible. I mean, it's, the truth. I know. That's not.
Here's
I know,
a recommendation.
That sounds terrible. It's not horrible. But the truth is, the HERE apps were a big deal. But in the navigation department in particular, that's actually one area where they fell short. And part of the problem was live information. So if you've ever used Google Maps to navigate around, you know that it will prompt you to say, hey, there's been an accident ahead. If you take this exit and do this little whirly round thing, you'll save 5 minutes. Or it's really, really good about that stuff. And it's always been pretty good about it. The HERE Maps, or I should say HERE Drive in that case, stuff was never particularly good at that. I don't think that this adds anything to that equation per se. I still think that the live data thing is a Google strength. But I guess my point is, if you're on Windows Phone and you want something native and you want something that's at least as good as what we had with HERE, which I think is kind of the point, it sounds like a roundabout criticism, but it's not too shabby. I think that's the nicest thing I can say about it. It works and it works pretty well. It's not up to Google map standards, but we don't have Google Maps on Windows Phone. So this is what we got.
The last time I was on, the show title was "It's Not Terrible." And now it's like, "It's Not Horrible."
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I see a trend.
It's almost like a trend, yeah.
It's not quite a trend. It's so sad. Yeah. All right, let's get to good news. We've got some good news from Mary Jo Foley and the Enterprise Pick of the Week.
Yes, there's a new Azure service coming. There's a lot of Azure services, but this is a new one that I think is going to ultimately replace Azure Rights Management. It's called Azure Information Protection. It's going to be available in public preview sometime in July. And what this thing is a combination of Azure Rights Management as it exists today and this additional technology from a company that Microsoft bought last fall called Secure Islands. Secure Islands lets you kind of classify and label data. Rights Management lets you kind of track who has access to the data and kind of maintains the tracking information wherever your data is stored. So if it's on-prem, if it's in the cloud, if it's on different types of mobile devices, say you have an Office app on your iOS device, it'll tell you who has permissions to view the different information across that particular application. So this new Azure Information Protection service is going to kind of soup all this up and make it and even, I guess, more secure version of Azure Rights Management. So right now, we don't know how much this is going to cost. We know that it's going to be in preview in July. We know that it's going to be generally available sometime later this year. And that's about all we know. We don't know anything about licensing yet. We don't know for sure if it's going to replace RMS. But we should know a lot more as we get closer to general availability. They just announced this today. That's why we don't know a whole lot. But it's out there anyway as the enterprise pick.
And preview coming in July, so people who want to play will soon be able to get their very own copy. Mm-hmm. What about the code name pick of the week?
So since we were just talking about confusing Microsoft names of products, I thought this would be a good code name this week. The thing that's codenamed VS15 or Visual Studio apostrophe 15, that actually is a code name, which I know a lot of people who are developers may realize, but some people may not. I see a lot of people refer to VS15 as Visual Studio 15, but that's not really what it is. VS15, I think, is the code name for the product that ultimately will be named Visual Studio 2016 if it comes out this year. The reason I made it the, I know, yeah, just to keep things really confusing. So if you see VS15, it means the next version of Visual Studio. It does not mean the current version of Visual Studio. But the reason I made it the pick of the week this week is late last week, Microsoft talked a little bit more about how they're going to streamline the experience around installing Visual Studio 2016 or whatever that next version is. And why this is interesting is a lot of people, when they talk about installing Visual Studio, they're like, oh man, it is so slow. It's so gigantic. I can't stand it. It just takes forever and it makes me install all these things I don't want. So with VS15, Microsoft is tailoring this whole installation experience. So you're going to be able to pick and choose which pieces of Visual Studio you want to install when you first have are installing the product. So say you only want to use it for Linux and IoT development using C++. You'll be able to actually get that granular when you install this and choose that set of components when you install it. Or if you only want to do universal Windows platform development, you'll be able to pick those sets of components. So this is really good news. Right now there are 17 different groups of components that Microsoft has kind of streamlined this down to. But if you want to look at their list and give them feedback as to, hey, you should also add this or you don't really need this, they have a survey, which I linked in my story about this, that you can go and complete and give them some feedback on how they're evolving this. So again, I don't know if this actually will come out this year in final form, if it'll be called Visual Studio 2016. I had heard that as a rumor. But if it doesn't make it out this year or if it's coming very late this year, it actually may end up being called Visual Studio 2017. Just to keep it really confusing.
And the next version of Windows is going to be called codenamed W9.
Just
to keep the convention going on.
Exactly.
Just to keep it equally confusing.
I know, right?
I love code names. You know what also people, I mean, I don't do it myself, but I enjoy watching people get drunk. And so I just wish there was a part of the show that was dedicated to bringing out the best beer picks possible.
Well, interesting idea.
There is, Padre.
Oh, well, tell me all about it.
Yes. My beer pick of the week is called Smooth Beats Miami. And before anyone gets riled, even though this is an IPA, Paul, it actually is not a hoppy IPA. It's very moderate on the hops, and it also tastes exactly like real toasted coconut. Not that fake suntan lotion coconut taste at all. It tastes really like true, real coconut or coconut water. It's a collaboration beer between two really good breweries, one of them here in Queens, which is called Finback, and the other one is called J. Wakefield, which happens to be in Miami, hence the name Smooth Beats Miami. I get a lot of people asking me for beer picks from Miami, craft beer picks, because I guess a lot of people go there on vacations and whatnot. So if you do go to Miami, you should look for this brewery called J. Wakefield, because I've had a number of their beers and they're all really good, but this Smooth Beats Miami is a really nice non-hoppy summer IPA worth a try.
When they say summer IPA, I don't really know what does that mean?
So it's not, you know, some IPAs are very malty and heavier. Like I think of them more as a winter IPA. Some are super, super hoppy, which you could drink any time of year, but this one just kind of feels like a summertime beer. Like you're at the beach, listening to some smooth beats, drinking your craft beer.
So it's not that you can only make certain types of beer at certain times of the year. It's just you want a different beer when it's hot versus when it's cold. Okay, I can get that. Cool.
Yeah.
Is there a summer scotch?
That I don't know. I'm not a scotch buff.
Yes, you add more ice to it.
It's a very versatile drink.
Yep.
Indeed. Well, thank you for that. We didn't have this last time, but we've got some events that I think our audience needs to know about. Who takes this?
I don't mind taking it. Mm-hmm. Next Wednesday, everyone, we're going to be doing Windows Weekly live at the Microsoft Store in New York City, the store that's on Fifth Avenue. We did it once last year. We're doing it again this year. Paul is coming down to New York, and we're going to have the show live in the store. So if you happen to be in New York on vacation or you live here, work here, you should come to the store and come to our show. It's going to be at the usual time, 2 to 4. It's on the second floor of the Microsoft flagship store, just where it was last year.
And after we're done, we're going to attack the Apple Store.
Yeah, then we're all going to the Apple Store. We're going to sing Christmas carols.
That would actually be awesome.
We're going to grab wooden cutlasses and just run down the street.
It's a little flash mob.
Oh, man. Yep. Oh, man. That would be hilarious.
Well, I mean, they wanted to bring things to the Apple Store. There we go.
Right. That's right. Yep.
But there's also something coming up in July, right?
Yeah. Well, after next week's show, if you're around, and if you can't come to the show, you should come to our meetup. We're going to have a meetup at Rattle and Hum West, not the regular Rattle and Hum, the one that's on 39th between 8th and 9th. We'll be there probably around 4:35, and it's just going to be open. So come on in. Join us, have drinks, food. We'll all be there. And then July, Paul and I are both going to be in Toronto for the Worldwide Partner Conference. On Wednesday, July 13th, we're going to be doing Windows Weekly live from the Partner Show. So if you are an attendee of the Partner Show, you should come to Windows Weekly live. We're going to start around 2:30, and we're in the schedule for Partner Shows. So you can just look us up and you'll find the room number and all. And we're probably going to also have a meetup in Toronto, but it's probably going to be Tuesday night. We just haven't finalized the details still on that yet.
Yep.
So those are our events.
If you're anywhere near New York, there's some fun stuff coming. If you're anywhere near Toronto, there's some fun stuff coming. That's what we do here on Windows Weekly. We like to spread the joy around the planet.
Yes.
Like that. That's
the Santa Claus of Windows.
Oh, Paul, Mary Jo, thank you so very much. Again, I love doing this show. Anytime Leo goes away, I beg onto Windows Weekly because this is just a fun time of geeking out. In a world, really, especially in San Francisco, that's really kind of dominated by apples. It's nice.
I haven't noticed that. What do you mean?
I know. Go figure, right? Of course, Paul Thurrott is the mastermind behind Thurrott.com. So if you need to find out anything about what's going on, Paul, what's the best way to find you?
Thurrott.com. Thurrott.com. At Thurrott on Twitter.
Any big stories coming up that you can share?
No,
with
but
us?
I mean, we have the Windows 10 field guide, which we're updating right now for the anniversary update. So there should be, I should have updates for that every week going forward now for a while. But I just put out an update for the new Edge stuff, not coincidentally.
And what I was just thinking is maybe I should show up to the New York event and the two of us can just play Xbox next to Mary Jo.
That sounds good.
That'll be good.
They have the best Xbox setups in that store. You would have a blast.
We could play some Gears of War.
Sure.
Or the new Battlefield. That actually looks really good. Actually, the new Titanfall. Okay, no, let's not get back into that.
Cuphead.
Cuphead.
Have you ever discussed Volkswagens?
Jeez, no. Don't.
Oh, wow. I did not know about this one. Now I do.
Let me tell you something about classic Volkswagens.
Of course, the anti-Volkswagen zone would be with Mary Jo Foley over at the ZDNet blog, all about Microsoft. Mary Jo, of course, you can't tell us about the stories that you're working on, but if they wanted to find out what else you do, where should they track you?
You should look for me on my Twitter handle, at Mary Jo Foley. I don't talk about it a lot on the show, but I do a column once a month for a magazine called Redmond Magazine. So I write there mostly about enterprise stuff, but sometimes even about gaming from a strategy standpoint, not player standpoint.
Sure.
So Redmond like Magazine.
Strategies like if you're playing Call of Duty multiplayer.
No, not that kind of strategy. Oh,
you know, the financial strategy is just part of the game. So you really are a gamer.
No.
Okay. I was stretching
Redmond
it.
RedmondMag.com. I have a lot of columns there that you could check out.
All right. Well, if you need to find Mary Jo Foley, you can either find her there or at Rattle and Hum in New York.
Yeah, that's the other place.
On the intersection of what was the street again? Where is that located?
The one we usually go to is on 33rd between between Madison and Park. Sorry, Park. No, yep. Madison and Fifth. No, Madison, how did I not?
Right.
Yep. I just go there on autopilot, kind of.
Yep. So do I, actually, but and I don't even live there. But we're not going there, so don't remember that address. Where's the other one? Where's the one we're going? It's over by Times Square, right?
Yeah, the one we're going to is 39th between 8th and 9th. That's the Times Square one.
Okay.
Paul, Mary Jo, always a privilege, always an honor. Thank you very much for tolerating me on this
episode. For us as well.
Yes, thanks for doing the show with us.
And folks, don't forget that you can catch the show live on Wednesdays at 11 o'clock a.m., Pacific, or p.m. Watch it on demand at twit.tv/WW or wherever fine podcasts are aggregated. I'm Father Robert Ballas here in for Leo Laporte, who will be back next week after his super secret mission. Till then, have a great day and take your dose of Windows Weekly.